This is the Packet Pushers Weekly Podcast, the greatest ever data networking podcast to be located in a well-ventilated virtual office space with free coffee, comfortable chairs, and an unquenchable thirst for all things networking. Today's show is sponsored by LightCyber. LightCyber brings active breach detection technology to your data center and using modern software technology to continuously scan the network and locate the attackers after they're through the perimeter and all up in your network stealing all the things. Because security. We talked about it before, and we're going to talk about it some more. Packet Pushers is a place where no one has to speak in terms that business people understand, where nerdy is the normal and deep dive is the baseline, and you can metaphorically smell the fumes of the virtual whiteboard markers in your ears. Joining me today is Mr. Ethan Banks. How are you today, sir?
Hey, good. It's summertime here in New Hampshire. It is a post-conference for us for a number of things, although LightCyber is one of the ones I got to speak to at Interop, where we chatted about what these guys are doing that is different, and this is why I'm actually really pleased to have them on the show, since I think I blogged about this. I might have gotten a little too excited about LightCyber in a certain sense, but what they're doing is very cool, so I'm pleased that these guys were willing to come on and sponsor a show and talk to us.
Fantastic. So let's introduce the people on the show from LightCyber today. First of all, it's Jason Matloff. Jason, tell people a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Ethan. It's good to be on the show with you. I am the Executive Vice President here at LightCyber. I've been in the networking industry and high-tech industry for about 20 years, primarily focusing on networking and network security. And I'm pretty excited about what we've introduced here with active breach detection.
Excellent. And with us also is David Thompson. Dave, tell people a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm David Thompson. I go by DT because there are so many Davids running around this world. I've been in security essentially my whole career. I took about a year and a half off, and I'm very excited to come back because it seems like security has been fundamentally broken, and I think we actually have a way to really fix it for folks, and I'm very excited to talk about that today.
Outstanding. Okay, so what we're going to be talking about today is how LightCyber detects post-intrusion targeted attackers on the network. That is, once they've punched through your firewall, because we know that passive defenses are reasonably easy to breach. We've seen time after time after time companies being compromised and then months later the data being leaked out on the internet in the public sphere, you know, breaches of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and now millions or tens of millions of records are becoming so common and causing damages to the companies that are associated. So what we want to be able to do is talk about how LightCyber addresses this. How do we pick them up after they're through the perimeter? And then how do we make it so that accuracy and operational efficiency in detecting that is the thing because of the reasons that we'll discuss here. So let's kick off first by getting an overview of LightCyber's focus. What is the problem you're trying to solve? What's unique about how LightCyber does this?
Thanks, Greg. Exactly as you mentioned, we've introduced a new category of security infrastructure that we call active breach detection that presumes in the starting point that you can or already have been breached. And so we're addressing one of the biggest problems in the security industry, which is not just the escalating number of breaches, but more importantly, the fact that these breaches, once the attacker gets a foothold in your network, compromising either a user account or a host, they have unfettered access to the network and typically have months to be able to perpetrate their attack. So what we're doing that's unique with active breach detection is using behavioral profiling and anomaly detection as opposed to technical artifacts to find these attackers during the actual act of their attack, looking for the signals of their attack, the behaviors that by necessity are required for them to succeed in perpetrating that attack. So we use those behaviors and behavioral profiling as an alternative to technical artifacts, which is the mechanism that all the legacy threat prevention systems use to stop the initial intrusion, which are inappropriate in the act of trying to find active attackers that are in the midst of their attack.
What you're getting at there with technical artifacts, what you mean is the signature-based services where you're looking at the payload or you're looking at something within the packet. Oh, we have a signature match. This is a data pattern match. And then that triggers, we think that there might be something going on here. You're saying don't just look at signature kind of stuff, those technical artifacts. Look at behaviors and say these behaviors are indicative of a compromised host and now we're going to act.
The way I like to look at this is from the operator's perspective. For 20 years, we've essentially given them an impossible job. We've said, you need to use these signature type systems to build a perfect defensive perimeter to keep all the bad things out. And if any one thing slips in, you've failed at your job and it's game over. And the reason that this is a problem is because the attackers have essentially unlimited opportunities to tweak their attack, to try another phishing email or a variant of a virus until something slips through. Asking our operators to have a perfect score, about 100, it's just ridiculous. And so instead, we need to look at, you know, what to do afterwards, because it turns out just getting the email clicked on or getting a virus in isn't the goal of attackers. What they want to do is steal your data. And so we want to construct a mechanism where we can help our IT operations, our security folks, catch these bad guys when they're in the process of the attack and kick them back out. So kind of redefine victory on terms where we can win. Mm. As opposed to letting the attackers have all the advantages.
Yeah, you still need your firewalls, you still need your IDS systems because they are your perimeter. You need to define a perimeter in the same way that your house, you still lock the doors and the windows in your house, right? But inside your house, you might put in a burglar alarm which detects somebody who's moving around your house when you're not there. Hmm. That is a breach detection.
Exactly. Right. If you look at the last 20 years of security infrastructure, we've gone through generation after generation of threat prevention infrastructure that is promised to be the next thing closest to Nirvana. But each one of these systems uses just yet another technical artifact to try to find those attackers, which is inherently prone to both false positive and false negatives. So while, exactly as you said, Greg, they're necessary, they're just not sufficient.
Yeah, and like a home alarm, the big problem, and we'll talk about this more in a minute, is anybody who's had a home alarm knows that it goes off all the time. And that's the biggest problem, because once your home alarm goes off all the time, people stop responding to it. And that's the biggest problem with that sort of metaphor. So our ability to detect people once they get through the perimeter, and there's a lot of ways to get through a perimeter these days, like your average firewall lets traffic in. The continuing reliance on simple protocols like HTTPS or HTTP means that your firewall actually doesn't prevent anything anymore when 80% of your traffic is just HTTP traffic coming in. So you need to do more than what it is. How are you doing the detection of this differently? What's unique about LightCyber's technology in this space?
The way we're tackling this is by, instead of focusing on a single packet or single file or single flow or a single point in time and making an instantaneous sort of yes-no decision, good, bad, what we're doing is we're observing, we're learning, we're using, you know, data science or statistical techniques to learn what is normal and to continuously compare what we're seeing against what we call attack detectors, or, you know, the kinds of behaviors that are indicative of an ongoing attack. So we're doing behavioral profiling and looking for anomalous attacker activity. And we can take the benefit of this approach of detection versus prevention to take our time to understand whether an attack is manifesting or not. We don't need to stop it in the first packet or the first second or even in the first day. In an advanced attack where the target is, you know, the data or systems of an organization, takes weeks, months, sometimes even years to manifest. So if we can give an accurate signal in a day or a week, can allow our defenders to take action before the damage is actually done. The net difference is that behavioral analysis and learning.
The key there is, rather than flagging on, oh, I saw one little thing that might indicate there's a problem and you should act on it, and flooding with alarms, you're taking a lot of data and compiling it all together and going, you know, based on a careful consideration of all this evidence, we have a, you know, a high probability that this is an infected host you need to deal with.
Exactly. It may make sense to drill down a little bit and talk about what we're actually doing. We provide the solution as an appliance that sits on the network and connects to a tap or a span. And so it's looking at, you know, full network traffic, DPI. As well, we have a agentless software technology that goes out and interrogates endpoints. And so, yeah, we're continuously examining this network and endpoint data, learning what users and devices do, and thereby able to detect the anomalies that an attacker by necessity introduces.
This is a good time for us to say, what are the pieces and parts of this system? You said something listening off of a span port. You said there's some agentless technology that allows you to query endpoints. So maybe let's just break this thing down for the engineers that are on the podcast here and describe what is it that they're installing that is doing this analysis.
Yeah, we have an appliance or a virtual appliance that we call a detector that sits next to a spanner tap, and it ingests full network traffic.
Ingesting full network traffic, which means different things to different environments. How much data can one of these boxes handle?
We have a range of platforms that can connect anywhere from, you know, sort of a 1 gig copper up to a 10 gig fiber. And the way we scale out is by pushing more detectors down and throughout an organization. So we're going to want to be, you know, near the core of the data center. We can also, you know, move out closer to, you know, where the users sit in branch offices as appropriate. To that end, we also actually have a probe also available as an appliance or a virtual appliance that can do the ingest piece, but then pass off metadata to the detector for the actual analysis and profiling.
So would you say that the span it's listening to would be east-west in the data center? Where would you advise customers to position so that it's getting the data that you want to capture?
Yeah, great question. What we want to focus on is primarily data that's traveling between workstations and servers. So we want to see, you know, the DHCP traffic, we want to see the Kerberos logins, we want to see all the file share access, we want to see all the access to the servers and apps, and we want to see the outbound traffic, anything out to the internet. So we don't look at any inbound traffic, and then workstation-to-workstation traffic is really great, but not necessary. So we can include it or not, depending on, you know, the desires of the customer.
So it's mostly north-south, stuff that's coming in and out. You're looking for maybe exfiltration kinds of patterns?
I guess it's north only, so it's the outbound side. So there, okay. We're looking at exfiltration and command and control, the kinds of things that, well, frankly, many solutions look for. So we really focus on the east-west traffic to find the active attack activities that are going on, many of which don't actually involve any kind of malware at all, that look like abnormal administrative operations even. And so the majority is on east-west.
It's called going lateral, getting lateral escalation or privileged escalation. Once you're through the firewall and you're inside the network, maybe you've just got a user account, not necessarily root. You want to be able to then escalate yourself to root and then start scanning around the network to see what you can find. Or if you're doing a targeted attack, you know exactly what you're looking for. Maybe you're looking for, in the case of industrial espionage, you might be looking for the customer database or the plans of a specific product or some chemical thing, right? Some critical piece of data. Once you're in, you need to start going lateral to find that. So your product is looking for patterns of activity that look like, hey, that's going lateral, but that's not normal. That's not usual.
Correct, yeah. And even in a targeted attack, even if the attacker knows what they're looking for, they don't know where it is. And that's really the advantage we use against them that we can help IT leverage. I mean, in theory, we know our networks really well. We know where things are. We know where data is located. In practice, it's hard to actually operationalize that knowledge and use it to find these anomalies. But what our system does is it learns, you know, what the patterns of connectivity are at, you know, sort of the layer three level, you know, what ports and protocols are used between different devices. At a higher layer, we look at the usage of applications and, you know, administrative operations, file share access. So when the attacker arrives, even if they know they want, you know, data file X, Y, and Z, they need to still figure out where that is. So they're going to start poking around. Where are the file servers? And they'll do, you know, port scans, and they'll look for SMB, you know, shares that are open. As they're looking, that's an anomaly. They'll start accessing, is the file I'm looking for here? No. Is it here? Here? No. Is it here? No. Is it here? Oh, yes, yeah. Fine. But that's another anomaly. Like, who pokes around like that? Well, the answer is attackers.
Yeah. Unless you've got a scanning tool.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So it's a trivial configuration to say, oh, this isn't a normal network operation that we see. And you can tag that and say, you know, we don't need alert.
This is my internal vulnerability scanner that scans, you know, every day. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, tell it that it's there.
Exactly, yeah.
If I've got one or more detectors then that I've put on the network so that I can analyze the volume of traffic I want to analyze, does it report up to some central device that ingests all that data or?
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for bringing us back to the original question. So yes, there is a master that would then aggregate all of the information from disparate detectors and provide a central interface for the administrator or security to take a look at and see a single pane of glass with all the various alerts, or we call them breach indicators. And then one of the things, we spend a lot of time on the network side, I want to make sure we don't forget about the endpoint. We think it's critical to combine both. So the other thing that the detector and the master provides access or information into is the results of our interrogation of the endpoints that are out there. So as we're developing suspicions based on network activity or as part of a regular kind of scan that the administrator can configure, we reach out and we understand or learn what are the processes that are running on these various endpoints, what are the executables that are there, what are kind of the open or listening ports that are there, and that data is brought in. And we do a profiling or differential analysis on that as well. So we can immediately surface suspicious executables or files, things that are low prevalence or rare in the environment, And we can start to correlate that with the network information. So we see something that looks like a port scan over on this machine. We see that, you know, Sally from HR is logged in, but we also see that PowerShell is being used, and we see that MMAP is being used, and we say, well, hang on a second, that doesn't compute. That right. looks really wrong. Alert.
Yeah. Sally and HR just got awesome somehow. Wow. When did she get those skills?
go Sally. We need more women in IT. But, I mean, that's the unique part about, you know, when I was reviewing the documentation to be prepared for this, is that not only are you taking data from inside the network and looking for patterns in the packet flows, you're then saying, if I see something that is suspicious, I'm going to go to the endpoint and get data from the normal tools that everybody uses to manage servers and operating desktops and so forth, and interrogate that for status information and say, is something happening in that box?
This is a key differentiator for us in that we have both the network and endpoint context in a single detection domain, which provides dramatically higher accuracy and operational efficiency. So whereas today, if you had some form of anomaly detection based on flows, NetFlow, or log-based systems, it has more or less a very high false positive rate that has to be triaged and researched, and then you have to go do analysis of the endpoint on some other system. So by having both the network and endpoint context in a single detection domain, and then providing additional investigative data on the endpoint, what anomalous processes are running, are there any known MD5 hash associated with malware on the device or not, all that information is very helpful to reduce the triage and investigation time and increase the operational efficiency for the incident responder. So it's a critical differentiation for us to have that integrated network and endpoint context.
So I want to talk about those false positives there. What you're saying is, or the alerts, right? You know, we joke on the show fairly regularly about IDS systems. Everybody's got one, but none of them are turned on. Because as soon as you get like 5 weeks or 6 weeks of alerts constantly going off and you spend time trying to research and work out, you just end up just turning it all off and ignoring it, right? And that's a real problem. That is, A, too many alerts on and not useful alerts, and false positives. That is, I found something, a heinous crime is being committed, call out the emergency police or whatever it is. And then when you get there, you go, actually, no, that's just the latest Microsoft virus update and we haven't patched yet or something like that. Why not? How do you handle that? I mean, that's just so common, but how does Light Cyber handle that?
We don't even call our alerts. We call them breach indicators because they're such a higher quality and so much more accurate in actual alerts of active attacks that are going on in the network. And they require, therefore, much less triage and research. But let's talk about it in specifics. So the specific examples you gave with IDS and maybe a SIM system, those alerts are driven by two things. One is technical artifacts that result from that produce a large volume of false positives because the artifact that you see might or might not, in most cases, does not actually result in a detonation on the network. So you're chasing a bunch of
events. Detonation on the network. I love that idea.
Yeah, just thinking exactly. That's a great term.
Well, it's the reality of false positives, right? There's these systems, the IDSs, the sandboxing systems, they see a ton of malware. I mean, the presence of malware on the internet today is overwhelming. So if you alert every time you see malware, it's not indicative of actual events that need to be responded to.
Let me ask you to clarify something there, because you mentioned just a second ago when you do probing of endpoints that one of the things you can do is look for MD5 hashes of any process that's running and see if it matches up with malware, which means you can use those sort of technical artifacts or, you know, signature,
exactly.
if you will, but it's just not what you rely on. It's just part of the larger
exactly.
pool of information.
It's what we call augmentative data. So it's investigative data to provide more accuracy and operational efficiency for the incident responder. So instead of alerting every time we see it on the wire, on the network, we are looking first and foremost for the behaviors of the attacker on the network and then follow up on the host to see what has detonated on the host. So as opposed to looking for all undetonated presence of malware or protocol anomalies or, you know, whatever the technical artifact the system might look for, we only look for it after we see the behavior of the attack on the network. So it's a much higher fidelity, much more efficient way to go hunt for attackers.
So in that scenario, you just using as confirmation of what you think you already know, we're seeing bad behavior. And oh, and by the way, since we saw the bad behavior, we think we found, or we also found this malware, which kind of confirms what we thought already.
Exactly. And it gives the incident responder all the data in a single UI to very quickly follow up and take action. So instead of having to go investigate again all the false positives and go do host inspection on a different system and find, you know, any types of anomalous known or unknown malware that's there, it's all presented in a single system, all with that confirmatory data so that they can respond immediately.
Now, you guys were critiquing, you know, the volume of information and the false positives that come up from log entries, say syslog, and NetFlow data. Is this the same scenario where you can use that as well, but, you know, you have your heuristics that do the behavioral match first and then use that other data, or do you really not bother with NetFlow and syslog stuff?
We don't need NetFlow, for example, or syslog, because we have, again, as DT described, we have full network access doing DPI. So we're seeing the full session flows. So we see much more than it would be implied by what you can infer from a NetFlow, you know, a 5-tuple or whatever it is.
You're sucking the full packet that are traversing the network. You're seeing them all. And again, you're doing DPI. So that would be redundant and or incomplete and possibly misleading information coming in from syslog or NetFlow kind of data, NetFlow particularly.
Exactly. Definitely, because one of the key things that enables our approach is really understanding what we call the strong entities, but really the device or the user that's involved here. So we want to know whose laptop it is. We want to know it's Greg's laptop. We want to still know it's your laptop, even if you're in another office in another continent. And we want to kind of build a long-term profile of the kinds of things your laptop does and the kinds of things you do with your user accounts. And it's against those that we compare our attack detectors. Without that, you know, specificity, it becomes very difficult to impossible to really understand this anomaly that an attacker introduces if they were to, say, infect your machine or steal your credential. If you're just seeing NetFlow, you're seeing IP level information, you don't really know what's at the other end anymore because IPs obviously can be reassigned so frequently. And it then becomes very difficult to get out of that noise sort of the important information about attack activity because the anomaly is lost.
So what all this stuff leads to is operational efficiency, which in our experience dealing with mid-market enterprise customers, they're overwhelmed with logs, alerts, whatever the case may be. So by not using things that are incomplete information, things like NetFlow or, you know, presence of malware or logs, and by instead using full payload content, full awareness of you know, deep packet inspection, we can provide much higher fidelity and accurate breach indicators, which allows the incident responder to be very focused. And one key data point that we're very proud of in our 40 commercial deployments that we have right now is that our average customer experience is they get 3 to 5 breach indicators a day, which is a totally consumable, manageable amount of information. And it's a result of the system and the architecture of us focusing on both network and endpoint and having full application awareness through DPI.
So, and this is the part of this solution that got me all excited, and I might have just engaged in some hyperbole on my blog. but let me describe why. So the last two networks that I've been dealing with, from a security standpoint, I was managing the firewall infrastructure, and I was also managing the logging infrastructure for those environments. So a set of firewalls scattered around the world, dumping their logs centrally into a manager. Well, I was getting millions of records per day. What good was that data to me, generally speaking? Well, nothing. So why was I logging them? I was doing that logging just for forensics in case something blew up and we found out about it. We'd have some amount of records to paw back through and hopefully find some root cause. You know, in the second environment I was working in, we were doing the same kind of thing. All the perimeter firewalls dumping to a central log server. And again, what was it good for? Not much in real time. We were trying to set up some searches and trying to be able to flag on certain events. It was hopeless. There was just way too much data that went through there, meaning the usefulness of the data was simply historical. If something bad happened, maybe we could go back through the logs and figure it out and try to, you know, lessons learned kind of thing, but not especially useful in actually figuring out that you have a breach today and what are you going to do about it? How can you find that in millions of log records? You really can't. Very difficult. And so you guys come along and say, look, we're doing the behavioral analysis that is going to show you that you have this specific host's is likely to be infected or malware or is exhibiting some kind of a problem you have to go deal with, and it's only 3 to 5 alerts today, that's, again, manageable. It's meaningful information. Now I've got something I can go and act on with an expectation that the problem has been found, and now I just need to go and deal with it rather than, gee, I wonder if I have a problem.
Absolutely. Operational efficiency, as I said before, is the most critically needed thing in the mainstream enterprise customer base that we're focused on. Your average 1 to 10,000 person organization has one or maybe a handful of security operators in its entirety. They have other people managing network firewalls and desktops, but in terms of true security analysis, they have a small handful number of people. Those people are overwhelmed, just as you described, Ethan. They're overwhelmed with logs today.
Or a half a person.
And
yeah, because they might have three other things they have to do in addition to dealing with the security infrastructure in the even smaller organizations.
Exactly. And what I want to be clear about is that the environment that you described, the analyst has to know what they're looking for in order to find it. They have tons of data. They have great data. All these systems are excellent big data systems to collect enormous amounts of data. But you have to know what to look for, which means you need very high paid security analysts to write the algorithms, to do the research, to do the triage of the whatever comes out of their analytics. So what we do is completely automate those functions so that if there is a half a person or one person, they have three things that they can focus on each day to mitigate any attacks that have started or are in process. That is a critical junction and a kind of a fundamental new set of features and functionality that are desperately needed in the security industry.
I just want to pick up on that thing. One of the interesting things about this is that when you look at, like the Target breach or the Primera breach or these other things, the attackers were actually inside the perimeter for months. More than 6 months in most cases. And that's partly because, as Ethan said, he wasn't able to process all the information and make it into something usable. And that's the thing here is that these breaches don't just happen and a day later or hours later it suddenly just blows up. Quite often these attackers have been inside the network for 6 months or more, locating the data consistently, slowly. And then even once they've got the data, it can take a month to work out a way to exfiltrate it without setting off any alerts or something like that.
Mm. Absolutely. It's well known, and I think it's been publicly disclosed in numerous media reports, that the Target breach involved FireEye. And FireEye is a great company, a great product. They invented something very novel, the whole sandboxing space. But the reality is the FireEye and other threat prevention systems throw off thousands of alerts. And the problem is those alerts are buried in thousands of other false positive alerts. And it takes, as we've been talking about, dedicated, very, very expensive security analyst resources to cull through those, to do the investigation and triage in order to find the important nuggets that have to be responded to immediately. What we do is completely automate those functions by looking for the signals of the attacker that by necessity, as we talked about earlier, are required for the attacker to be successful. The initial reconnaissance to look for, hunt down whatever assets that they're trying to exfiltrate or damage or whatever their objective is. The lateral movement to steal the credentials, to move from host to host to get to that data. And meanwhile, the command and control communications and eventually the exfiltration. We're looking for those signals throughout whatever period they have access to the host or the network. We're looking for those signals. So we have thousands of opportunities to find the attacker during the active attack phase of their attack, which effectively all the other systems, Greg, if you've been referring to earlier, the network-based or host-based antivirus, firewall, sandboxing systems, once the attacker has circumvented that system, they're blind to whatever type of lateral movement, reconnaissance, and other things that are occurring during the attack phase. And that's why today the attacker has access for months and weeks at a time.
One of the things I'm interested in here, we know this isn't a signature-based system, although you can use signatures to help inform behavior detections you've made. But behaviors themselves can kind of change depending on what clever tricks an attacker might be using. So is Light Cyber doing some kind of ongoing research and then updating the platform that does the heuristic detections? How does that work?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. What we focus on, we call universal attacker behaviors. So the kinds of activities that an attacker attacker has to engage in. There has to be some mechanism of communication between the host they've compromised or the account they've compromised and the external internet. You know, that's often referred to as command and control. Mm-hmm. The problem with looking at only command and control is that the attacker controls both ends, and so they have almost an unlimited set of things they can do. I mean, obviously, you can find a lot by looking at, for example, load reputation domain traffic, but they could be using Twitter and Gmail as the CNC channel. So we look for indications of CNC, things like, you know, periodic traffic to low-frequency domains on a network, totally irrespective or independent of the reputation of the domain. But as we said before, we focus much more on the reconnaissance and lateral movement pieces. Here, we've defined behaviors, you know, things like scanning, looking, searching, learning, impersonating, you know, account abuse or use that are generically defined that don't really have anything to do with the technique or mechanism. So the shorter answer to your question is there's a set of defined behaviors, and we're continuously introducing more or tweaking the ones that we have. But it's a process that, you know, it requires an update, or the calls for an update every couple of months, every 6 months, as we refine these things, because the behaviors are much higher level. Again, it doesn't matter if they're using Nmap or Ping or Metasploit. You know, the network traffic that results from that is a behavior that we can detect. So yeah, we do tune those, and we do add more when they hit the accuracy thresholds that we define as required to hit that metric around a number of indicators per day. But it's a slow moving process, and that's I think a huge advantage, because it means, for example, if you have a network where you need your devices offline with no internet connectivity, our system works great in that environment because we don't need signature updates.
Now that brings us to a discussion. You have a cloud system as well that a customer can choose to have to extend the capability?
We do, yes. So we talked about the detectors doing the network ingest and analysis. We talked about Pathfinder doing that investigation or interrogation of the endpoints. When Pathfinder finds a suspicious file or executable, and I should say executable or process related to that, data files, we identify that totally within the premises of the customer, show that in the dashboard and say, here's a set of files that are rare in your environment, they're associated with network traffic, et cetera. Optionally, those can be the binaries only, or first the hash and then the binaries themselves can be uploaded to our cloud for that further analysis we talked about earlier. So that's where we do the MD5 hash analysis to see if it's a known virus. We have a multi-engine AV system. We actually have a sandbox in our cloud as well. So we're doing that binary analysis in our cloud service.
Okay, so you're extending. So obviously, inside your data center, there's this, you know, this engine that you've got, which is putting together the data from the endpoint and what it's finding on the network. But when you find a threat, you're then able to upload it to the cloud and then perform a second phase of analysis, which is what most people are doing these days. I mean, this is a very common approach because you can bring in, you can correlate data from dozens of companies and thousands of sources and say, you know, is this executable, a virus? Scan it through 10 different AV engines, or you can run it up in a VM and see if it does something malicious. Am I right? Am I on the right track here?
That is exactly what the function performs, yeah. And as we said earlier, what this really does is automates a lot of the things that the analyst would be doing manually without our tool. But we do have customers in different verticals that have, you know, very stringent security requirements and prohibit this kind of upload. Mm-hmm. And it's still very valuable to them to get this report back of the anomalous or rare files, including the hash of that file, so they can go and pull it down themselves for analysis, or they can take that hash to their own tools internally for analysis. So the system works quite well, both connected or disconnected. Yeah. But obviously, the more functions you turn on, the more value you get.
Yeah, I just wanted to flag it because it's like, I'm thinking more, again, you know, although large-scale enterprises need this type of feature and they will be the ones who, you know, exporting stuff, security data to the cloud is challenging for them mentally. And, you know, let's not talk about security people having mental problems. But this idea of exporting it in the mid-market, though, is incredibly powerful because I just don't have the resources to track all of the, you know, the security vulnerabilities that are announced. Literally every day, it seems, there's some other, you know. And Microsoft, for example, is moving to a continuous patch schedule. There's no more Patch Tuesday. It's It's going to happen every day. Whenever there's something to ship, it'll ship, and you don't have time to react to that. It's just going to happen. And you'll need coverage between, you know, vulnerability and shipping of a patch code. So the cloud stuff can be quite useful. And that ability for you to correlate between all your customers and find stuff and bring in threat intelligence from external sources. Now, no doubt you're dealing with companies who have threat intelligence and adding it to your engine on a continuous basis. That makes the whole thing far more effective.
Yeah, exactly. We have first-party and third-party intelligence in our cloud. I just wanted to reiterate that it's completely under the control of the customer in terms of only upload hashes, upload nothing, upload hashes and binaries. Mm. And just to be 100% clear, we never upload any kind of data file. So we're only talking about sort of binaries or executable files.
Yeah. I think this cloud thing is the way of the future once we all get used to it and you can build up a trust relationship with the capabilities. But the only way you're going to have up-to-date signatures and access to unique threat intelligence is to have it centrally located where there's vast repositories of information ready and being updated in real time.
I was going to just respond to Ethan's specific question about how does our behavioral profiling differentiate from traditional technical artifacts, as we call them. And as DT said, one significant one is that we're looking for the behaviors, the generic behaviors at a higher level than, and there's no specific signature or MD5 that is technically defined by a researcher, which is self-evident in DT's prior comment. But the second significant thing is related to those users and devices that we're profiling, the attacker can't possibly know and mimic the behavioral profile that we've created on them, that the system automatically creates on them. So there's two aspects of our superiority, so to speak, of our detection system versus traditional technical artifact-based systems. One is that we're looking for behaviors, generic behaviors. The second one is because profiling is specific to the environment, the devices, the users that are in a specific environment, it's virtually impossible for an attacker to mimic that behavior once they land on a compromised host or user account.
Your point being there, the MD5 hash isn't something that the attacker can know and say, that's what they're going to hash on. I'm going to tweak this and tweak that, and therefore that I can work around that hash.
My point is that the MD5 hash check that we do with Pathfinder is actually secondary. It's augmentative to the primary detection that we do, which is network-based, the user behavior, the device behavior. And those are all we're looking for anomalies, anomalous attack behavior to the baseline as the primary form of detection before we even get to MD5 hashes and checking for anomalous processes and executables that are running on the host.
Got it. Okay. I thought you were taking me down a different road. I'm with you. I get what you're following there. Hey, why don't you guys take a minute and thump your mighty chests about some of the cool things that you've caught at customer sites? Now, I'm going to assume that you can't actually tell us the customers specifically and what they found, because that would be awkward for everybody. But if you could give us some examples of some of the things that Light Cyber has caught, that would be pretty cool.
Why don't I start with a couple, and then DT, maybe you can throw out some. I mean, there's obviously tons of examples we see on a daily basis across our user base, and we'll anonymize them. So a couple examples. So for example, we caught a compromised host that was using a tunnel to tunnel back through a home gateway as its exfiltration path. And we found this by finding the anomalous tunnel, the anomalous domain that it was connected to from that particular host that it obviously never connected using this particular protocol and port and to that particular domain. That's one example. Another one, actually very appropriate and timely relative to the recent growth in CryptoLocker, is we added a new detector. Ethan, coming back to some of your questions, you know, we look for behaviors. The behavior of CryptoLocker, once it lands on a particular host, is to start writing bulk encryption blocks to remote file servers. And so we look for that. And recently, with the introduction of a new type of detector looking for that, we were able to discover CryptoLocker in a few accounts in just the last month.
In addition to that, one of the scariest or maybe most interesting things we found was actually in the course of an evaluation. And this was at a higher tech company, found anomalous network activity, network traffic, both kind of internal, lateral, or east-west, as well as outbound kind of command and control-like. And upon the further investigation that we've outlined, looking at the endpoints in question, an anomalous file was uncovered, but it was one that essentially had no antivirus or threat information associated with it whatsoever. And one of the interesting things about our system is that actually a negative result like that is incredibly powerful. If you see anomalous network activity and an anomalous file that's unknown, that's actually really, really bad news. And it's not something that your typical, you know, perimeter system can tell you about. Obviously, they're already giving you enough alerts about, you know, the malware they see. They can't also tell you about the things they don't know of as malware. This behavioral view let us uncover this, and then, you know, it was quickly determined by the IT analysts on the site that the machines that were affected were the ones that were of the CEO, CIO, CFO, basically the entire C-suite, the head of engineering and the head of engineering's direct reports. And it was very clear that this was an, you know, APT-style, you know, intellectual property theft and had been underway for a very long time, you know, so for months before we got there. And, you know, no existing system had been able to uncover this. But even in our learning period, in an evaluation period, of course, of a couple of weeks, we saw enough anomalous activity in order to uncover this. It also highlights one of the most common questions we get, which is, what happens if you're installed in this learning mode and something already really bad is there? And the answer is, we can find it because we're looking for anomalies not just in time, so as in, you're starting to do something you never did before, but also as compared to peers. You know, why are you doing these odd things that look like attacker behavior in, on only these 8 or 10 machines when, you know, the vast rest of your network doesn't do things like that? And so it highlights, one, our ability to do that, you know, catch things that are in place already, and two, you know, the fact that there's some scary stuff going on out there.
All right, I think we need to wrap it up around about here. We're getting to where we want to be, and I want to sort of point out the fact that most people today are still working on passive security. So even if you're using stateful firewalls, which is the lowest level, or even if you're using the next generation firewalls, which have some sort of state tracking or advanced inspection capabilities, they still don't really cover the gap in the sense that they do more like IDS-like stuff. They get deeper into the inspection, but they're not actually doing deep mining of the data set. They're not actually using heuristics and artificial intelligence type ideas, not true artificial intelligence, but that sort of idea. And that's the sort of gap where the light cyber is moving into. That's how I see it, is this idea of doing deep recon to discover stuff that's happening inside the network after the perimeter. You still need a perimeter, but light cyber complements your strategy and finds out if somebody's already breached you and are trying to exfiltrate your data. So thanks very much for Light Cyber for sponsoring today's show. So let's just ask them to say thanks. So first of all, Jason, can you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Greg. We can be found at www.lightcyber.com, and we look forward to hearing from you all.
And DT, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm at SanctionT. I tweet often about what we're doing here. That's SanctionT. And I'm also on the Light Cyber website.
Thanks very much. And I'm Greg Farrow, and also with us today is Ethan Banks. As always, you can find us on the website at packetpushers.net. You can find more information in the show notes. We'll have a blog post accompanying this show that'll have some links and some more details to and references to white papers and other information that should be interesting to you. We would, of course, love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Don't forget to check out the Packet Pushers website at packetpushers.net, leave comments, or follow us on the Twitter as at packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.